Again, we want to extend a welcome to all of our visitors that are here this morning. We have a number, and we're certainly grateful for your presence, and want to invite you to come and be back with us any opportunity that you might have. I'm sure it'll be obvious, if it isn't already, that I'm not the regular preacher here. I'm filling in for Caleb, who's at home sick this morning. And I've been struggling with a respiratory illness myself, so if I get the coughing, I've got my water bottle over here and cough drops, so hopefully we'll be able to get through the lesson and hopefully have some good points that we can meditate on. I'm sure you've all heard the expression, nice guys finish last. As best I can tell, that was attributed to Leo Durocher back in the early 40s. And it had to do with sports. And, of course, the implication of that is that if you're a nice guy, you're not going to do well in sports. They want people who are aggressive, take no prisoners. And if you look at modern sports today, that seems to be kind of the model that people look for. But what about another fields of endeavor? Do nice guys finish last, or is there an advantage to being a nice guy? And when I was still working in the Methodist hospital system down in Memphis before I retired, all of the leaders from time to time had required books that you had to read, and most of them were, you know, it's just kind of the flavor of the month club, but one of the books that we were required to read was a book called Give and Take. It was written by Adam Grant, and it was to look exactly just at this proposition. Do nice guys finish last in business or in society in general? Or what about companies? And if you think about it, it has to do with, it really impacts a lot of the way you run your company. You know, the kind of people you hire. Do you want to hire aggressive, hardworking, take no prisoners, get ahead kind of guys? Or do you want to get people who are nice to each other or helpful to each other? And, you know, what about your leadership? You know, usually when we think of leaders of big major companies, we think of hard-driving people who really, they're out for number one in their company, and they're very aggressive kind of people. So this was an interesting book, and it had a lot of scientific studies behind it. So the basic premises in the book that they looked at is that companies generally have three types of employees. They have givers, they have takers, and they have matchers. Okay, well, giving is as what you might expect. These are people who they give more of their time, their talent. They help coworkers without expecting any kind of payback. So somebody who might be working on a project, sitting at their computer, somebody else comes up and said, can you help me with this project? What's their response going to be? Go away, I'm really involved. I just don't have time to help you right now. You know, go see if you can find somebody else. No, the givers are going to put down what they say or what they're working on and say, sure, I'll help you. And they help you with that project. Or maybe, you know, after hours or whatever it is, you know, they're always willing to give of their time, give of their means. If your kids are selling Girl Scout cookies or whatever it may be, the band, you know, and you have kids in the band, you can always hit up the givers because you know they're good for some money, right? Or if you forget your lunch money, you go by and you ask them, and sure, you know, here's 5 or 10 or whatever it may be. I don't know what lunches go for now, but they're all a lot more than they used to be. So givers, as you might expect then, they give. They give their time, their talent, their effort, help other people without expecting any kind of payback. Takers, on the other hand, again, are what you might expect. They take what they can get from other people. They're very aggressive, and they rarely give anything in return. Or if they give anything in return, it's just a manipulation to get something else out of that individual. Okay, so we all know those kind of people. What about matchers? Matchers do both. They give and take, but they keep score. So if you're coming to me at my desk and I'm working on stuff and you need help from time to time, that's fine. I may help you, But then if I need help and I go to you and you turn me away, I'm going to be very reluctant next time you come to my desk, right? Or whatever it may be, an outside project. And somebody who's not here today might come to mind when, you know, we have work on the farm and call me up and say, hey, can you help me with this or that? And then, you know, over time, hey, I need you to help me out doing this. Well, I'm busy. I can't do that. So I'm only teasing. I'm just picking on Marvin because all of you, Marvin has that reputation, and he's actually very willing to help anytime I need help from him. He may tell me I'm doing it wrong the whole time that he's helping me out. So anyway, that's what matchers do. They give and take, but they keep score. And if they sense that the score is getting out of balance, then they do what they can to make the score even up. Okay. Well, we're not here to talk about books that are written for companies and executives, but we might just think about it, because our society certainly looks at this, and society has the idea that nice guys finish last. So what was what's the premise of the book, and what's the final outcome? Well, as it turns out, in sports, givers are probably the ones who finish last. Okay? But in companies, or in medical school, or many other endeavors that you look at, givers over time tend to rise to the top, which might surprise you. Takers who are very selfish may start at the top, but over time they tend to drift down, and their companies tend not to do as well. So if you're in business, you may want to think about that. But we really don't care what business has to say. We're here to study the Bible, right? Well, what does the Bible have to say about givers and takers and matchers? Or are there people in the Bible who would fit any of these categories? And as it turns out, there are. I want us to think about Joseph for a moment. Joseph and his brothers. Joseph was the youngest. He was babied by his father. He was shown favoritism by his father. We all know the story that he was given a coat of many colors, and his brothers hated him. They envied him. They were jealous of him. He was treated very unjustly, eventually sold into slavery by his brothers, goes down to Egypt as a slave. But even in his slave condition, as he's working for Potiphar, he rises to the top. Okay, would you think that Joseph was a good guy, or was he a taker? Well, from the Bible account, it looks like he was a very good guy. In fact, he was so good at what he did and so willing to help that eventually Potiphar made him the head of his house. And Potiphar didn't concern himself about anything, but he put everything into Joseph's care, with the exception of his wife. And his wife tried to tempt him to sexual immorality. Joseph didn't go along with it, and he was unjustly accused by the wife of Potiphar, ultimately thrown into jail. Here he is now. Once again, he's a nice guy, but it looks like he's finishing last, right? He's in a dungeon controlled by Pharaoh. He's been thrown there unjustly, but while he's there, the warden of the dungeon recognizes that Joseph was pretty good at things, and he puts things into the hand of Joseph. Joseph helps out the warden. Ultimately, he helps out the butler, or the cupbearer to the king, and the baker. Now, while the baker came to no good, the cupbearer was restored to his position. But he forgot Joseph, right? So Joseph's brothers were takers. The butler and the baker were takers. They took the interpretation of the dream that Joseph gave them, but they forgot him, or at least the one who was restored to his position forgot Joseph. Ultimately, an opportunity came for him to give something to Pharaoh, an interpretation of a dream, or two dreams that Pharaoh had, which were both the same. Well, you know the story, how he was elevated, comes now from the deepest, and he's elevated to where he is now the ruler over all of Egypt, and nobody higher except Pharaoh. And Pharaoh doesn't even concern himself about the affairs of state. because Joseph is handling everything. And he is a very wise administrator. So he prepares the land of Egypt for all of the famine that is about to come, the 7 years of famine. First the 7 years of plenty, and then the 7 years of famine. And then, while he is in this position, Joseph's brothers show up. So here's Joseph's opportunity to be a matcher. Settle the score with his brothers, right? But what does he do? We all know the story. He's kind to his brothers. He makes sure that they're not still mistreating their other brother, who is Benjamin. So he wants to verify that Benjamin indeed is alive. And it's obvious to him that his brothers are ashamed of what they had done to him, but they don't recognize him. And ultimately, he reveals himself to them, and they're very frightened because they're concerned that Joseph is now going to exact his vengeance. He doesn't, because he has realized that God used him to save his family. Not only save his family, but to save a whole nation, the nation of Egypt. And to save many others who came to Egypt to buy grain. So ultimately, he was a giver. He was a nice guy. But he finished first. What about Abraham and Lot? We know the story about how the land became too crowded for Abraham and Lot. And their herdsmen were fighting. So Abraham, being the older and the one who had taken care of his younger nephew all this time, he sends Lot off and says, "I'm going to take the best, and you can just kind of make your own way," right? Is that the way Abraham did it? No. Abraham was a nice guy. He came to Lot and he told Lot, "You look around and you choose. If you go that way, I'll go the other way." So what does Lot do? Where is Lot? Is he a giver, a matcher, or a taker? Well, we all know he's a taker, right? He looks, he sees what's the best part of the land, what's well watered, where will the herds survive the best and thrive. Unfortunately, that area turned out to be towards Sodom and Gomorrah. And so Lot pitches his tent towards Sodom. He picks the best land. Ultimately, he ends up living in Sodom. So even after Lot got the best, what happened? The Mesopotamian kings come down and they capture all of the Sodomites and take them off into captivity. Abraham could have just said, "Well, it serves him right. He shouldn't have gone down there. I let him choose where he wanted to live." No, what does Abraham do? He gathers all of his men, gets a coalition of others, and they go after Lot and all the ones who have been taken captive. And they defeat the Mesopotamian raiders. And the king of Sodom offers everything to Abraham, all of the spoil. "Just give me the captives and you can have everything else." What does Abraham do? "Yeah, I'll take that. It's mine. I put my life at risk to come down and rescue you guys." What does he do? He says, "I'll not take anything, not even a sandal from you, lest you say you made Abraham rich." But on the way back, he does meet somebody. And who is that? It's the king of Salem, Melchizedek. And he gives Melchizedek a tenth of everything that he has taken, everything that he has. Abraham was a giver. Lot was a taker. Sodom and Gomorrah are about to be destroyed. What does Abraham do? When God comes to tell him that Sodom and Gomorrah are about to be destroyed, Abraham says, "Well, it serves them all right down there. They're a bunch of wicked people. They're horrible. I don't know why my nephew ever ended up living with them." No, he intervenes on their behalf. And he says, "Will you destroy the righteous with the wicked?" And he eventually bargains down to where if there are even 10 righteous people in the city of Sodom, the Lord has promised that he would not destroy them. Obviously, there weren't even 10 people because he ends up destroying them, but he saves Lot. But what does Lot what happens in the destruction of Sodom? Lot, even though he is saved, he loses much. He loses all of his possessions, all of his flocks, everything that he owns. He loses his wife, and he loses his sons-in-law. And ultimately, even his daughters, in a sense, because they commit incest with him, and he has two sons, Moab and Ammon. Are the descendants of Moab and Ammon good people or wicked people? They're wicked. And ultimately, the nations of Moab and Ammon are destroyed by God. Lot is saved, but he was a taker. And ultimately, God settled the score as far as his decisions had consequences, right? He was not the giver that Abraham was. What about David? David, usually we think of as a giver, right? With regard to King Saul, he was a giver. David could have taken King Saul's life on several occasions. From a worldly standpoint, that would have been justified, right? In fact, it looked like Saul was just placed in David's lap on several occasions, and David could have had him killed. Saul was certainly out to kill him. Saul was a taker, right? He was very jealous of David. Even the fact that David, when the women would sing about how many Philistines that had been killed, Saul has killed his thousands, but David his ten thousands, right? Saul couldn't glory in the fact that both of them were being extolled in the song, but the fact that David was being extolled more in the song made him jealous. And he then began to see David as a threat rather than as a loyal, trusted servant that he was, the one who had killed Goliath when nobody else was willing to step up. But instead, David spared Saul's life on more than one occasion. He trusted in God to settle the account. So in this situation, David was neither a taker nor a matcher, right? And ultimately, he became king of all Israel. His kingdom was expanded. He became very wealthy. And even after Saul's death, he continued to show kindness to Saul's family. Other kings would have, when they became king, what would they do? Boy, they'd go and they'd kill all the rest of the potential rivals right off the bat. And then you don't have to worry about him anymore. Think about Jehu, how he went and all of the descendants of Ahab he had put to death. But not David. David spared Saul's life, spared the lives of his rivals' sons and daughters. Mephibosheth, he allowed him to eat at his table, even though there may have been some treachery on the part of Mephibosheth later on, who was the son of Jonathan. In that situation, David was a giver. But we all remember the story of Nabal. Let's turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 25. Nabal was not a good man. In verse 2, we find out that Nabal lived in Carmel, Mount Carmel, which is up close to the sea. It was a high hill that overlooked all of the valley of Jezreel and then looked out toward the Mediterranean Sea. Verse 2, it says, the man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And it came about that while he was shearing his sheep in Carmel, the man's name was Nabal, his wife's name was Abigail. The woman was intelligent and beautiful in appearance, but the man was harsh and evil in his dealings, and he was a Calebite. He was descended from the tribe or from the descendants of Caleb. Caleb was actually from the tribe of Judah and should have been kindly toward David. David was a fellow tribesman from the tribe of Judah. Verse 4, David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel, visit Nabal, and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say, have a long life, peace to you, peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. And now I have heard that you have shearers, Now your shepherds have been with us, and we have not insulted them, nor have they missed anything all the days that they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we have come on a festive day. Please give whatever you find at hand to your servants and to your servant David. What is David asking here? He said, my men protected all of your shepherds. You're a rich, wealthy man. You've got lots of sheep, lots of goats, lots of cattle. You're very wealthy. We protected them all during the summertime or all during the time that they were shearing the sheep. Now, it's a holiday. Can you spare a few loaves of bread? Can you spare some meat to feed my men? It's not an unreasonable request. And what happens when David's men come to him? In verse 10, Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who are each one breaking away from his master. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men whose origin I don't know? So what's David's reaction when he gets back and says, the guy's just, you know, he's just a hothead. Let's just go on. We'll get our food somewhere else. No, what happens here? David switches from being a giver to a matcher. Right? I helped him. He ought to help me. I'm keeping score now. And what does he do? He heads up there to try to kill Nabal and all of Nabal's house. And if it's not for the intervention of Abigail, he would have done that. Verse 14, one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, behold, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he scorned them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we were not insulted, nor did we miss anything as long as we went with them while we were in the fields. They were a wall to us by day and night, all the time we were with them tending the sheep. Now, know and consider what you should do, for evil is plotted against our master and against all his household. And he is such a worthless man that no one can speak to him. There's no question about Nabal's character. He is definitely a taker, right? But David has gone from being a giver now to a matcher. He's going to settle the score. So you know the rest of the story, how Abigail hurries and she gathers up bread and jugs of wine and five sheep that are already prepared and measures of roasted grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and loads them on donkeys. And she takes them and she meets David in the way. And she turns away his anger. And even David later on says that she had saved him from taking his own vengeance. So in this situation, David was just barely escaped the trap of becoming a taker and one who would take his own vengeance. There was a third time, though, where David actually becomes a taker. And all of us know the story of Bathsheba and Uriah, how David commits adultery with Bathsheba. Uriah is out fighting his battle. David didn't go out with Joab and the rest of the army this time. He stayed back in Jerusalem. And he commits adultery with the wife of Uriah. And ultimately has Uriah put to death, even though Uriah is his faithful servant. Uriah was a giver. On this occasion, David was a taker. And because David becomes a taker in this situation, he pays the consequences. His family pays the consequences for generations to come. And David, it's to David's everlasting regret that he commits this sin. Now, what about the New Testament? The New Testament makes it clear that all of us should be givers. There's no question about being takers or matchers. Jesus relates the story of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan, if he'd been a taker, the Samaritans and the Jews hated each other, right? So he sees a Jew who's been beaten and robbed and left for dead, but yet he feels compassion for the man. And he stops and he binds up his wounds, he pours oil on them, takes them to an inn, pays the innkeeper, and provides for the man. He shows compassion. He didn't have to. The priest and the Levite had passed by on the other side. They are the ones who should have helped. But they didn't feel any obligation to help this person. What would the Good Samaritan have expected in return? When the guy woke up, being Jewish, he probably wouldn't have said, "I can't believe a Samaritan took care of me." This man was a giver. We're not to be matchers. We're not to keep score, take our own vengeance, nurse grudges. Over in 1 Corinthians 13, let's turn over there for a moment. Verses 4 through 7, love is patient, love is kind, is not jealous, does not brag, is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly, does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered. That's a tough one to do. When you've been wronged, what's your first inclination? I'm going to get even. I'll remember that. Next time you want something from me, just remember, okay? But that's not God's way. Does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices in the truth. Bears all things. Doesn't keep score. Bears all things. Believes all things. Hopes all things. Endures all things. That's God's way. We're to be givers. In Romans chapter 12, in verses 14 through 21, Paul writes, "Bless those who persecute you, bless and curse not." Again, that's a tough one. "Rejoice with those who rejoice, weep with those who weep, be of the same mind toward one another, do not be haughty, but associate with the loyal, with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation." A matcher or a taker is not going to do these things. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. We are not to take our own vengeance. God is going to take care of it. "Respect what is right in the sight of all men, if possible, so far as depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, but leave room for the wrath of God, for it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink, for in so doing you will heap burning coals upon his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." Be a giver. We all remember the story of the ungrateful steward in Matthew chapter 18, who owed this tremendous debt, and he begged his master to forgive him, and the master graciously forgave him, but then he went out and found another fellow slave who owed him much, much less. But he was unwilling to forgive him, but grabbed him by the throat and choked him and said, "Pay what you owe." Ultimately, the one who had been forgiven the great debt was thrown into prison because his master was angry when he found out. Verse 33, "Should you not have also had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you?" See, that slave was a taker, and then he just kept taking, right? Even though he had been with his master, who was a giver, his master forgave this tremendous debt, way larger than what had been owed him. It's interesting that this story is told in the context, go back up to verse 21 in Matthew 18. And who was it that asked Jesus the question that prompted this story? Peter came to him and said, "Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him?" What's Peter doing here? He's being a matcher. Okay, my brother sins against me. I can go 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times. If my brother sins against me 7 times, and that's kind of the limit after that, I don't have to forgive him anymore. So he's keeping score. What does Jesus say? No, not 7 times, but up to 70 times 7. Makes the point that there you don't keep score. God keeps the score. It's not for us to keep the score. We need to be givers, not takers, and certainly not matchers. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, we find out that some of the Corinthians verses 1 through 8 have become takers. Because Paul has to set them straight. Does any one of you, when he has a case against his neighbor, dare to go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Verse 4, if you have law courts dealing with matters of this life, do you appoint them as judges who are of no account in the church? I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not among you one wise man who will be able to decide between his brethren? But brother goes to law with brother, and that before unbelievers. It's a defeat for you that you have lawsuits with one another. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be defrauded? Brothers taking brothers to law over frivolous things. Takers. That's what was going on in Corinth. They were takers. And not just rather being defrauded over it. Paul warns them severely about this. Jesus was a giver. We all know that. He healed many. He taught many. He ultimately gave his life for all. He didn't own a house. Didn't have a car. Didn't even have a chariot. They had chariots back then. Jesus, you would think, creator of the world, at least would have had a chariot drive him around so he could talk to the crowds. Just think how many places he could go if he'd had a chariot with a chauffeur, right? But no, he walked everywhere he went. Didn't have a bank account, but what an example for us. What an example for us. We should all be givers. Give of our money, give of our time, give of our talent, to our brethren especially, never expecting anything in return. What did Jesus say when you give a feast? Who should you invite? Invite those who can't repay you. Don't keep score. Invite those who can't repay you. The Lord will keep track of it. You'll be blessed. In the verse that we had Bob read earlier, Paul said in Acts chapter 20 and verse 35, it's more blessed to give than to receive. He also said to them that they ought to work hard and help the weak. He's talking to elders here, to Ephesian elders. Work hard and help the weak. It's more blessed to give than to receive. When we give, we gain far more than we give. We can't outgive God, right? God will bless us. And I'm not saying that this is the gospel of health and wellness, but generally speaking, the principle is that the more we give, the more we receive from God. God takes care of it. He's the one who keeps the score. And if you think about it honestly in your life, when you've been a giver, how much more blessed have you felt and been because of your giving? In Luke chapter 6, verses 27 through 38, in Luke's version of the Sermon on the Mount, or Sermon on the Plain here, Jesus said, I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. Whoever hits you on the cheek, offer to him the other also. Whoever takes away your coat, do not withhold your shirt from him either. Give to everyone who asks of you. And whoever takes what is yours, do not demand it back. Just as you want people to treat you, treat them in the same way. If you love those who love you, what credit is to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do the same. If you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? See, that's all matching. Even sinners lend to sinners in order to receive the same amount. Love your enemies and do good. Lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great. And you will be called sons of the Most High, for He Himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. God is the greatest giver of all. Be merciful as your Father is merciful. And too bad Caleb's not here, because he thinks Matthew has all of the compassion verses, right? Do not judge and you will not be judged. Do not condemn and you will not be condemned. Pardon and you will be pardoned. Note this, give and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, they will pour it into your lap. For by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you in return. God is the ultimate giver. He makes the sun to shine and the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. He gave us the most precious thing that he could give to save mankind. And he will ultimately give all righteous servants the gift of eternal life with him. So in conclusion, as we begin this new year, I hope that we can all be givers. Maybe you're not going to be first in sports if you're a nice guy, right? If you're a giver. But I'm here to tell you that in the scriptures, nice guys don't finish last. Ultimately, they finish first. And I hope that this will be something that we can meditate on in the next few days and that's been profitable for us today. If there's anyone here today who is not right with God, God is giving you an opportunity right now. He is giving you the opportunity to make that right with him. No matter what you've done, no matter how evil you think you've been, what could compare with what Jesus' own disciples did? They ran away. They deserted him. Or what Paul did before he became a Christian. He persecuted Christians, threw them in jail, perhaps even was a part in killing them. He certainly stood by while Stephen was stoned to death. And yet God was merciful to him, forgave him of that, and then he became one of the greatest servants of God that the world has ever known. God is willing to forgive. You have that opportunity today. You may not have it later today. You may not even make it home. None of us are guaranteed how much longer we have on the earth, but let's all resolve to be right with God and take advantage of opportunities to get right if we're not. If you're not a Christian, you have the opportunity also to come forward and express your faith in Christ as the Son of God and be baptized into Christ. But whatever your need may be at this time, we hope that you would take advantage of it. Come make your way to the front as together we stand and sing the song that David has selected.